Great Studies at Marine Corps University presents Iran and the Persian Gulf States Between Commerce and Confrontation, presented by Mr. Afshin Molavi. This is the sixth lecture in a series being hosted by MES and MCU entitled Framing the Iranian Challenge. Mr. Molavi is a senior fellow at the New America Foundation, a nonpartisan think tank. He has worked as a journalist in Tehran, Dubai, and Riyadh for the Washington Post, Reuters, and the Arab News of Saudi Arabia. He is the critically acclaimed author of The Soul of Iran, described by Foreign Affairs as a brilliant tableau of today's Iran. A frequent commentator on CNN and BBC, Mr. Molavi's work has been published in numerous academic and popular publications, including the New York Times, Financial Times, Newsweek, National Geographic, Business Week, among others. A graduate of the Johns Hopkins University, Paul H. Nitz School of Advanced International Studies in Middle East History and International Economics, Mr. Molavi currently specializes in the intersection of globalization, geopolitics, and geoeconomics in the Middle East, Europe, Asia, and the Gulf region. This lecture took place Thursday, 17 March 2011, 1400 to 1530 at Gray Research Center, Quantico, Virginia.
We have one more sixth lecture in the series being hosted by the Middle East Studies at the Marine Corps University under the name of Framing the Iranian Challenge. Those of you who have been with us, we have tried to cover different aspects of Iran-related issues. Today, I think we are very fortunate to have someone that I call a friend, but also someone that I think you will find very, very interesting in with the depth and his honesty and also with his understanding of Iran. I'm not here to sell this book. I'm going to sign right now. This book, The Soul of Iran, is, if you haven't read it and you are dealing with Iran, I highly suggest you read it. It's one of the best reads there is. There's a lot of political books that tell you something. This is, as the name suggests, is The Soul of Iran. So Afshin Molavi was in Iran. He covered Iran. Also, he was based in Dubai and Riyadh for the Washington Post, Reuters, and the Arab News of Saudi Arabia. And right now he's a senior fellow at the New America Foundation. He has appeared in numerous publications, media. Right now he interfaces and works with different government, U.S. government agencies, both from the military side and from the non-military side, telling them about Iran from the inside perspective. I have heard Afshin a few times, and every time I've come out more impressed by his depth, and also I have learned more. A lot of places we go, we come out and say, you know, I knew that, but I think by the end of this hour, we'll be more enriched. And another issue that I was sitting in Riyadh one day, just a few years ago, and I'm reading the newspaper on what I'm, and I'm looking at this, I see something, Afshin Molavi, in Arabic there is no vet. And I see, you know, this is about Malik Abdullah. So he had an op-ed in the Saudi paper, so I tore it because I didn't know if they ever sent a copy to him or not. So finally I'm seeing him, so here it is. Saudi paper. Without further ado,
thank you very much. Thank you. It's a pleasure. And thank you, Dr. Afshin. It's the fact that you've kept the newspaper for me for 2 years really is a wonderful a testament to your character and your honesty that you actually, when I came here, I actually thought, I remember you had said that you had kept the newspaper, but I thought, as soon as I came into his office, he showed it to me.
What I'm going to do today is talk about Iran and the Persian Gulf States. I always admire Dr. Tarzi's analysis of the region, and now I have to admire your timing as well, because as you saw, events in Bahrain have taken a very serious turn. There's a lot of talk about the potential for an Iran-Saudi proxy battle in Bahrain. I will discuss that as well. You know, the conspiratorial Iranian mind in me says that, you know, maybe you had this all planned just so we discuss this today. So you guys really do have a lot of power here in the United States. Speaking of conspiratorial Iranian minds, let's start with Mahmoud Ahmadinejad in this discussion. And what I'd like to do is talk about an aspect of the WikiLeaks cables that has not gotten enough attention, in my view. I won't go into the cables themselves. I know it can be a sensitive subject. But I thought Iran's reaction to these cables were very interesting and very telling about Iran's relations with its Gulf neighbors. So remember the first trove of cables that were released to the media? The headline in those cables were all Gulf states urging the United States to strike at Iran. Saudi Arabia's King Abdullah quoted as saying that we must cut the head off the snake. The Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi, Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan, urging the United States as far back as 2005 to strike at Iran. The King of Bahrain urging military action on Iran. This was dramatic, this was serious, this was in black and white for all the world to see. And what was Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's reaction? Well, this might have been a good opportunity for him to thump his chest a little bit, to tweak the Gulf states. It might have been an opportunity for him to push back against the King of Saudi Arabia, push back against Bahrain or the United Arab Emirates. But what did he do? Instead, he said, this is a plot. This is a Zionist plot, this was his words, to sow disunity among Iran and her Arab brothers. You know, I say with brothers like that, you know, who needs enemies? But it was very interesting. And subsequently, you did not see an IRGC commander, for example, come out and make a tough statement against Saudi Arabia or Bahrain or the United Arab Emirates, despite the fact that it was all in black and white in print that they were calling for U.S. military action. This is a very significant reaction that I thought was worth noting at the beginning of this discussion. And I attribute this to 21 years of a culmination of Iranian policy beginning in 1989 with the presidency of Hashemi Rafsanjani, in which Iran moved away from its confrontational policy towards its Persian Gulf neighbors and more of a policy of détente, rapprochement, and commerce. Hashemi Rafsanjani, upon taking office, said something that was very interesting. He said, you know what, we need to stop making enemies around the world. He began the process of rapprochement specifically with Saudi Arabia. Now, this is very significant, because in the discussion about Iran, the discussion is often, is Iran an ideological actor, or is Iran a pragmatic actor? I don't like either characterization. I think Iran is a survivalist actor. In the instance of Saudi Arabia, what Iran did, if from 1989 on to the Khatami era, beginning in 1997, was basically turn back the legacy of Ayatollah Khomeini. If you want some light reading one time, go back to Ayatollah Khomeini's last will and testament, and I'll read some excerpts for you. In Ayatollah Khomeini's last will and testament, he reserved some of his most vitriolic scorn for the Al-Saud. He did not call them the government of Saudi Arabia, he just referred to them as the Al-Saud. He would not even refer to Saudi Arabia, he would refer to the country as the Hejaz, which is the western province of Saudi Arabia that houses the holy cities of Mecca and Medina. And I quote to you from Ayatollah Khomeini's last will and testament in the 1980s. In this age of oppression of Muslim nations, it is the work of the USA and the USSR and their local lackeys, such as the Al-Saud. And then in parentheses, it says the family of Saud and the rulers of the Hejaz, those are his own parentheses. These traitors to the house of God, the traitors to the great divine sanctuary, who deserve the most potent damnation by Allah. This is the words of Ayatollah Khomeini, his angels and prophets. So essentially Ayatollah Khomeini was saying that the that Allah, His angels and prophets should eternally damn the Al-Sauds of Saudi Arabia. And then he goes on to say that we note that each year King Fahd of Saudi Arabia spends a good deal of the wealth of the people in printing the Holy Quran and considerable publicity and propaganda material in support of anti-Quranic ideas, propagating the baseless and superstitious cult of Wahhabism. You know, this is in Ayatollah Khomeini's last will and testament. His grave was not even warm when Rafsanjani began his outreach to Saudi Arabia. So in this particular instance, pragmatism won the order of the day in Iranian foreign policy. In other instances, ideology wins the order of the day. There's therefore, I would argue that Iran's foreign policy tends to be more survivalist, and we can get into a discussion of that later. So, Hashemi Rafsanjani emerges as president of Iran in 1989 with his statement that we need to stop making enemies around the world. He begins an outreach to Saudi Arabia. Now, again, let's not forget, remember the context of this. Iran and Iraq fought a brutal 8-year war from 1980 to 1988. Some 500,000 dead on both sides, another 500,000 injured on both sides. Saudi Arabia and Kuwait basically underwrote Iraq's war effort against Iran. There's a famous quote in which King Fahd of Saudi Arabia says to Saddam Hussein, "You provide the rijal," rijal in Arabic meaning men, "and I will provide the riyals." And so in 1987, again, let's not forget, there was an incident in the holy city of Mecca in which Iranian pilgrims were using the Mecca pilgrimage as an opportunity to protest. And they would use this pilgrimage moment to protest against America, against Israel, and they wanted to politicize the holy pilgrimage. Saudi authorities were very uncomfortable with this. They didn't like this at all, and they had been warning Iranian pilgrim delegations against this sort of politicization of the annual pilgrimage known as Hajj. So in 1987, there was a confrontation. Ultimately, Saudi security forces fired on Iranian pilgrims. 275 Iranian pilgrims died in Mecca in 1987, and there were riots in Tehran calling for the overthrow of the Al-Saud regime. They overran the Saudi embassy. These were very tense times. Iran and Saudi Arabia and Kuwait actually came to blows in the Persian Gulf. You recall in 1984 when Iraq began hitting Iranian oil tankers. How did Iran respond? Iran responded by hitting oil tankers that were allied to Iraq, Saudi oil tankers, Kuwaiti oil tankers, and this was the time when the United States reflagged some of those ships, and ultimately led to a shooting war between the United States and Iran in 1987 in Operation Praying Mantis, which you all know about. So these were very tense times. So this was so the fact that 1 year after Ayatollah Khomeini's death, one year after the Iran-Iraq war ended, Hashemi Rafsanjani, the new president of Iran, would reach out to Saudi Arabia, said a lot. It was a very significant step. Now that period, there was still some suspicion among the Gulf Arab states about Iran, but then something else happened, as you all know. The first Gulf War, or what some people call the second Gulf War, the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait in 1990. Iran's stance during that invasion was a stance that is sometimes known as active neutrality. They basically decided not to take a position. They did not line up against the United States. They did not obviously line up with Iraq after fighting this brutal 8-year war with them. And they maintained a position what is known as active neutrality. This position won them a certain amount of trust in the GCC states and helped this gradual rapprochement between Iran and these countries in the region. Now we fast forward to the year 1997. Suddenly there's a new Iranian president, a fellow by the name of Mohammad Khatami. it looks as if there is a new wind blowing out of Tehran. Mohammad Khatami is talking about dialogue of civilizations. He's talking about mending fences with his neighbors. And I remember I was in Tehran in December of 1997 when Iran hosted the Organization of Islamic Conference Heads of State Summit. And this is the heads of state of 57 countries who are part of this Organization of Islamic Conference. And for the very first time, one of the top three officials of Saudi Arabia visited Iran since the revolution. Crown Prince Abdullah of Saudi Arabia visited Iran in 1997. And what was striking to me, just on an anecdotal level, is I was interacting with some of the members of the Saudi delegation at the conference center. And they knew so little about Iran. You know, these two countries separated by this body of water, known as the Persian Gulf, by the way. I'll just digress for a moment. I did a CNN interview recently, and I was just out of speaking very quickly, and I said, yes, Iran and the Gulf states. And I must have gotten 50 emails from Iran and Iranians, you know, saying, well, you should know better that it's the Persian Gulf. It's not just the Gulf. So so even the body of water, there's a lot of dispute over that. But in these two countries, separated by this body of water, knew very little about each other. I began my career as a journalist, as Dr. Kaiser noted, working in Saudi Arabia. When I went to Iran, I was struck by the stereotypes that Iranians had about Saudis. And when I went to Saudi Arabia, I was struck by the stereotypes they had about Iranians. So it started snowing at this conference center in Tehran. And the Saudi delegation all were, you know, standing out there and marveling at this snow. And some members of the Saudi delegation said, we had no idea it snowed in Tehran. So they didn't even know, you know, let alone the basic, you know, culture and politics of each other. They didn't even know the sort of the climatological patterns of each other as well. And so this rapprochement between Iran and Saudi Arabia, and I'm focusing on those two countries a little bit right now, and I'll get into some of the others because they're the most significant countries in the region, really hit its high point in the 1997 through 2001 period. When I was a journalist in Iran in that period, I was regularly attending briefings by the chief of staff of President Mohammad Khatami at the time. And one of the things that struck me was every other week or every other couple weeks, you know, he would give us a readout on which world leaders President Khatami was speaking to. It seemed to me, from my own attendance of these briefings, that Crown Prince Abdullah was either number one or number two in terms of the frequency of conversations that President Khatami was having with world leaders at the time. And part of this has to do with the fact that they just got along very well. As you very well know, in the politics of this region, it's often the personal relations between various leaders. And one of the problems that Iraq has had in its own relations with Saudi Arabia is that, from what my sources in Saudi Arabia tell me, is that King Abdullah just can't stand Nouria Malik. And is that your impression as well? Yeah.
That's
good. I mean, polite. Yeah. And so the state-to-state relations in some respects are sort of kept hostage to this personal animosity that the king has for the Iraqi prime minister. But these two leaders really seem to get along very well. Now, some of that began to change, particularly after the post-9/11 period, and particularly after the Iraq War. And as the post-Saddam future was looking like it was increasingly being shaped by Iran, this was getting Saudi Arabia increasingly frustrated. And I think Prince Saud al-Faisal, the Saudi foreign minister, articulated that frustration in the year 2005 when he gave a speech at the Council on Foreign Relations in which he said, we fought a war together, meaning Saudi Arabia and the United States, to keep Iran from occupying Iraq after Iraq was driven out of Kuwait. Now we are handing the whole country over to Iran without reason. This was the view that I was hearing on my trips to Saudi Arabia. It was suddenly Iran was no longer the friendly country of Mohammad Khatami, that we were turning a corner in our relations with. Now Iran was once again this sort of dangerous, nefarious force that was influencing events in Iraq. Visitors to King Abdullah, I was not someone who would sit with King Abdullah, but I would get readouts from senior American officials who would sit with him. They would tell me that he would have all sorts of conspiracies about the influence of Iran in Iraq and Iran's efforts to Shiitize many other parts of the region, and so it had gone back. And one of the reasons why it had gone back was enter Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. And again, let me go, you know, this is a tale of two summits. Remember I told you about the December 1997 OIC summit in Tehran? Well, in late 2005, there was another OIC summit, Organization of Islamic Conference Summit, and this one was held in Mecca. And this was, in many ways, King Abdullah's kind of coming out party, so to speak, to the Muslim world. Because he had just taken over as King of Saudi Arabia. He had planned, according to his some of his top advisors that I was in touch with when I was a journalist, he had planned a major speech. This major speech was going to focus on his vision of the Muslim world, which in his eyes was a vision of the Muslim world which is moderate, which is tolerant, which engages in dialogue, which supports economic development. And what happened at that Mecca summit? Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, it was also his first interaction with the King of Saudi Arabia, and he gave a speech at that Mecca summit that overshadowed King Abdullah's speech, because he spoke about Israel and the need to wipe Israel off the map, and that kind of got all of the headlines of this Mecca summit. And from that point on, there was a great deal of frustration and mystification with this particular leader. And again, you know, I bring up this point again, this is the politics of personalities, you know. This isn't necessarily, you know, the state-to-state relations. The King of Saudi did not like Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. And again, it hasn't come out in the WikiLeaks tables. I don't know if we're going on the internet with this, but from what I've been told on Saudi Arabia, is that he refers to him as the tea boy of Iran. He doesn't have any sort of respect for this president the way he has respect for Mohammad Khatami, or he has respect for Hashemi Rafsanjani. And that loss of respect is, I think, very important. And so this relationship has deteriorated. It has deteriorated not only because of the politics of personality, but it deteriorated because Iran and Saudi Arabia find themselves on opposite sides all across the region, all across Southwest Asia. They find themselves on opposite sides in Lebanon. They find themselves on opposite sides in the Palestinian territories, in Iraq, to some extent in Afghanistan as well. There is this sense of Tehran, Riyadh, and Riyadh engaged in a regional battle for influence, and generally speaking, they are on the opposite side. And so this deterioration in relations, what has it led to in reality? I think the danger right now is Bahrain. Because it's one thing when it's Lebanon or the Palestinian territories and countries that are sort of far away and regions that are somewhat far away. It's another thing when this country, Bahrain, which is right on the doorstep of both Saudi Arabia and Iran, which to some extent, we all know that Iran used to claim Bahrain as its 14th province. And you know, Iran has about 30 provinces right now. This idea of Bahrain as its 14th province goes back to the days when Iran only had 13 provinces, and Bahrain was declared in the late 1950s by some members of the Iranian parliament as its 14th province. And you recall when the British decided to withdraw east of the Suez and move away from the Persian Gulf, the Shah of Iran still made claims on Bahrain in the late 1960s. And he only withdrew his claim to Bahrain at the behest of the United Nations, when the United Nations actually sent a fact-finding mission to Bahrain and found that the Bahraini people did not want to be ruled by Iran. There was, you know, some machinations going on in this story. It's not as simple as that. The Shah of Iran was hoping that the British would trade his claim on Bahrain for these three strategic islands of Abu Musa and the Greater and Lesser Tombs. And as soon as Britain withdrew its forces from the Persian Gulf, the Shah of Iran promptly took over those three islands, Greater and Lesser Tombs. So in his eye, this was a trade. I'll give you back Bahrain, I won't claim it. But this idea of Bahrain being a part of Iran has never left the particularly some of the hardline figures in the Islamic Republic of Iran today. And the more you scratch some figures from the Islamic Republic of Iran today, and the more you talk to them, the more you start thinking you're hearing echoes of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi in their outlook, in their belief that they are the regional hegemon, in their arrogance and chauvinism towards their Arab neighbors, in their arrogance and chauvinism towards some of their Asian neighbors. This is old Persian chauvinism, but it happens to be now not under a king, but under an Islamic Republic of Iran. And so a couple of years ago, there were new claims on Bahrain. There was a Speaker of Parliament, a former Speaker of Parliament, who made a new claim on Bahrain. There was a hardline editor of a newspaper who was affiliated very closely with the Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who made a claim on Bahrain. But the difference is that after he made those claims on Bahrain, the foreign minister of Iran flew to Bahrain and apologized and said that we have no designs on Bahrain and we respect the territorial sovereignty of Bahrain, etc., etc. And so now the question is becoming, in some people's eyes, and some Iranians are saying, well, has Bahrain become Saudi Arabia's 14th province? Now this is the question that is emerging, and I'll read to you some from the Iranian press about how they are viewing the Bahrain issue. One thing that's worth noting, and I would recommend to all of you who are monitoring Iran, is when you're monitoring the Persian language media, and particularly the Persian language state television, and then you monitor Iran's Arabic language television. You know, there's a Arabic language television station called Al Alam that Iran has run since 2003, I think. They really started it on the eve of the Iraq War. And the idea was that they wanted to reach Arab hearts and minds. This is part of Iran's soft power. One of the interesting things is I took the March 14th BBC monitoring Persian language a television news broadcast, and I put it right next to the BBC monitoring of the Al Alam, the Arabic language broadcast. And when you look at the Persian language broadcast that was for the Iranian audience, the first 10 stories were kind of a mix of how Iranians are celebrating the Persian New Year, Nowruz, which, by the way, we are now in the Persian New Year. 21st is the actual date, but the holidays have already begun. There was also some stories about Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei visiting a convention center that was showing technology products, etc., etc. And there was maybe one story on Bahrain. But the first 10 stories on the Arabic language broadcast, Al-Alam, were all about Bahrain. And they were talking to Bahraini opposition figures, and they were talking to... And so clearly there's a difference in how they're playing those stories. But I'll get back to Bahrain and my thoughts on what Iran is doing on Bahrain, because I want to talk about the second most important relationship that Iran has in the Persian Gulf region, and that is the relationship it has with Dubai. I don't even say the relationship with the United Arab Emirates as a whole, because I talk about the relationship with Dubai. Because here is a real commercial relationship. When you look at Iran's top 15 trade partners, you find very few countries in the Persian Gulf that hit the top 15. But Dubai, the United Arab Emirates, is usually number 1, 2, or 3. Saudi Arabia is somewhere number 13 or so. Dubai, in many ways, is Iran's Hong Kong. Dubai is Iran's commercial lungs. Dubai helps Iran skirt sanctions, but Dubai is also a place where Iran engages with the outside world in various forms of legitimate business. At its peak a couple of years ago, Dubai-Iran trade hit about $14 billion. It's on the decline. right now, partly as a result of the Dubai debt crisis, partly as a result of four rounds of United Nations Security Council sanctions, partly as a result of U.S. pressure on the United Arab Emirates to cut back on trade with Iran. But when I look at the latest numbers, it seems that we're not seeing a major dent. If you look at the latest numbers just published out of Dubai, customs figures show that trade with Iran continued to grow in the year 2010, rising about 12%. To about 28 billion dirhams, which is, you know, what is that, about $9 billion or so, $8 billion or so. So it rose from the year before, but it's still not at the numbers it was at its peak. And let me just give you what an Iranian businessman said to me when I was when I went to Dubai about a year ago, and I was doing some reporting on the Iranian merchant community in Dubai. And this was 1 year ago before the heavier sanctions started coming on them. He said to me, and I quote, "Life used to be great here. Nobody bothered us. We just did our business. There was no politics and there was no mullahs." This was the Iranian businessman. "No troubles, but now it's a different story. Now banks don't want to do business with us." And he was referring to the tightening that Emirati banks have engaged in on Iranian business. He was saying insurance companies don't want to insure our ships because the biggest part of the Iranian business with Dubai is the re-export of goods that come from elsewhere, brought into Dubai ports, and are re-exported into Iran. And he's saying insurance companies don't want to insure our ships. And the Emirati authorities, he said, are looking at us with a suspicious eye. "This is not fair," he said, "we are doing legitimate business." And then he says, you know, "We built this country." This is the Iranian, you know, pride, and, you know, that, you know, we built, you know, Dubai. And, you know, there's 400,000 Iranians living in Dubai. There's 8,000 Iranian businesses operating in Dubai. It is the largest population of diaspora Iranians outside of the United States and Turkey. And this diaspora of Iranians is far more engaged with Iran itself than other diasporas, because they're just across. There's something like 300 flights a week from Dubai to Iran. Dubai is also, you know, the joke among Iranians, because Dubai has a nightlife and it's kind of the, there's a place you can get a drink in Dubai. The joke among Iranians is, what's the best city in Iran? And the answer is Dubai is the best city. And there is kind of this feeling of ownership of this city. And so these Iranian merchants are feeling quite let down. He said, "We built this country and now they are targeting us. What did we do? Leave the politics to the politicians. We are simply businessmen." So clearly there is a sense that Iranian merchants, life is not as good as it was for them a few years ago. The efforts of Stuart Levy at the United States Treasury Department, the efforts of the United Nations Security Council, and also what a very important factor in all of this is Dubai's debt crisis. You know, with Dubai's debt crisis, you know, a lot of this money was in real estate. Well, who were some of the biggest investors in Dubai real estate? Iranians. So Iranians actually lost a lot of money in Dubai real estate, and you know, I often joke with I had met Stuart Levy, and I joked with him. I said, you know, you've done a lot of damage to Iranian business, but Dubai has done a lot more damage to Iranian bottom line because of the money that they lost in the real estate sector. But what has also happened as a result of, you know, this environment is they're moving downstream to some extent. And now Ras Al Khaimah is becoming, we're hearing a lot about Ras Al Khaimah as the next center of Iranian re-export trade. I'll believe it when I see it in big numbers. It's hard to compare with Dubai's infrastructure. It's hard to compare with Dubai's port facilities. It's hard to compare with Dubai's R&R facilities, which is another reason why Iranians are flocking to Dubai. But within the United Arab Emirates, there was always some tension. Abu Dhabi, the capital of the United Arab Emirates, always had a much more suspicious eye towards Iran. always look much more warily on Iran. It was probably the worst kept secret that emerged in the WikiLeaks cables that the Abu Dhabi government wanted the United States to strike at Iran. I mean, those of us who followed these issues knew that the Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi, the Foreign Minister of Abu Dhabi, they were telling anybody who would listen that we need to take more aggressive action on Iran. And they were always a little bit uncomfortable with the Dubai interaction with Iran. Well, when Dubai hit its debt crisis, and Dubai needed money, and Dubai had to turn to Abu Dhabi, one of the strings that Abu Dhabi potentially attached, this is one of the things that I was hearing in the Emirates, was that, guys are going to have to crack down a little bit more on your trade relations with Iran. Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum could dismiss that to some extent before, when Dubai was looking very successful, and it was a little bit harder to dismiss that when Dubai was reeling under debt. What is the origin of this Iranian influx in Dubai? Well, it really goes back to the very beginning of the rule of the Al Maktoum family in Dubai in the mid-19th century. From the mid-19th century onwards, the Al Maktoum ruling family decided that if they wanted to be a significant player in the region, they needed to attract merchants to their shores. So they began offering all sorts of incentives for merchants to come to and set up in Dubai, tax-free incentives, customs-free incentives. And this was back in the late 1800s. They managed to get Iranian merchants and Indian merchants to their shores in the late 1800s. In the mid-1900s, there were three big migrations of Iranians to Dubai. One was in the late 1800s, early 1900s, when the Qajar kings in Iran at the time began squeezing some of these merchants and trying to get more tax revenue out of them. And the Al Maktoum rulers in Dubai were saying, okay, come to our shores. In 1936-37 was the second big migration wave of Iranians to Dubai, was when Reza Shah was also trying to squeeze them, but he also did something else. Reza Shah, the king of Iran at the time, mandated the de-veiling of Iranian women. Think about this for a moment. The police in Iran at the time were mandated to challenge any Iranian woman who wore a veil in 1935-36-37. And if they were wearing a veil, the police were authorized to rip the veil off of them. Well, think about this today, where it's the exact opposite. If you're not wearing a veil 70 years later, the police will challenge you and tell you to put on a veil. But for the conservative, traditional merchant communities along the southern Iranian Persian Gulf Coast, this was an affront. They didn't like this new world that Reza Shah was trying to create. They also didn't like the fact that he was squeezing them for tax revenue, so they moved on to Iran as well. And then after the 1979 revolution, when business was much tougher to do in Iran, you had another big migration of Iranians to Dubai. So there's an organic Iranian community in Dubai that has been there for many generations. And the other, some of the biggest merchant families of Dubai are of Iranian descent. And in fact, there's another joke about Dubai where they were having a drought, and Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid, the ruler of Dubai, urged all residents of Dubai to pray for rain, and pray for rain in your country. And so all residents of Dubai prayed for rain in their country. And the next day, there were monsoon rains in India and Pakistan, given the large numbers of the residents of Dubai from India and Pakistan. And then Sheikh Mohammed said, no, let's all citizens of Dubai, please pray for rain in your country. And obviously, this is a joke told by Iranians, and the next day it rained in Iran, So there is this sense of ownership of Dubai that Iranians have, which many Emiratis don't necessarily like. This is the two key relationships that Iran has, the Saudi relationship and the Emirati relationship. And so let me just very briefly just close on Bahrain and then open it up to some questions. I talked to you about some of the territorial claims that Iran has to Bahrain. I also mentioned that Iran tends to be a little bit more cautious when it is within its own neighborhood, within the Persian Gulf. They're not doing the sort of things that they were doing in a very serious way in the 1980s in terms of fomenting unrest among their neighbors. There is a lot of talk in Riyadh and in Manama among in elite circles about how Iran is seeking to foment unrest. I'm not someone who has spent a lot of time in Bahrain, but I have spent some time with Shiites in the eastern province of Saudi Arabia. And from my experience with the Shiites in the eastern province of Saudi Arabia, the sense I get is they just want to be treated like citizens. It's not as if they are, and when I talk to them about Iran, when I talk to them about Ayatollah Khomeini, there is a certain reverence that they have for Iran and Ayatollah Khomeini, but when I talk to them about which particular Shiite leaders are their marja, the marja being the source of emulation, all Shiites, as you know, can choose their source of emulation, the figure that they will follow, and they will follow this particular Shiite cleric's fatwas. Often they would say Ayatollah Sistani in Iraq, often they would say Fadlallah in Lebanon before he passed away. Rarely would they say Ayatollah Khamenei, or an Iranian cleric who believes in clerical rule. And you know, we were talking just before I began this discussion. When I look at these uprisings across the region, and some people are calling them, you know, pro-democracy uprisings, you know, I prefer to call them pro-dignity uprisings. You know, if you're finding people all across the region, unemployed, underemployed, frustrated at their lack of voice, who are rising up and simply wanting their voice to be heard. You know, when you look at the Middle East region as a whole, Iran being one of them, you look at the demographics of the region, you see two-thirds of all Middle Easterners under the age of 29. It's a significant number. You see, when you look at the numbers of married versus unmarried, you have, in the Middle East, North Africa region, the highest number of unmarried males in the world. And this is partly as a result of the fact that in order to get married, you need a certain amount of money, you need to be able to pay for a house. And so the demographers are right, in a sense. You know, large numbers of unemployed or underemployed, unmarried young men pose instability risks. And in many ways, we're starting to see that play out, you know, all across the region. And to some extent, that has played out and then you add another layer to it of if you feel that your particular group, and in the case of Bahrain, there's some extent the Shiites of Bahrain, your particular group is being persecuted. And the same with the Shiites of Saudi Arabia. Your particular group does not have the advantages that others have. And I think that's a very a dangerous and explosive mix that we're starting to see you know, all across the region. So what will Iran do in Bahrain? Will Iran potentially send in its own men, send in its own troops? I would find that to be very unlikely. It would be quite a significant provocation, because after all, Bahrain can argue that they invited the Saudi, the Peninsula Shield troops. They certainly wouldn't invite Iranian troops. Is Iran actively involved? I mean, are there intelligence agents in Iran? Dr. Tazi and I were talking about how this view of Iran's all, that there's a view in the region that Iran has this such significant power. They have cells all across the region. They're running all sorts of operations all across the region. And I often say that it's a bit like this mystique of CIA power in the Middle East. And I, you know, in my own interactions with some people from the intelligence community, one intelligence community officer said to me, "I only wish we had as much power as they think we have to do with." And I think to some extent, an Iranian intelligence officer may say the same thing, that he only wishes they had as much power as they attribute to us. Now, are there intelligence operatives operating in Bahrain? Of course there are. And there's a very large intelligence presence in Iranian intelligence presence in Dubai. There's an intelligence presence in Qatar and in Kuwait. Of course there are. But Dubai in particular, you've got a lot of IRGC front companies operating. Yes, of course. In Bahrain, you've got merchants who are in regular contact with intelligence. Does this mean that the Bahraini Shiite opposition is taking its orders from Bahrain? Everything I know about the Bahraini Shia opposition does not lead me to that conclusion. It does lead me to the conclusion that they have the same kind of grievances that we've seen erupt in Egypt and Tunisia and other places. And you add another layer to that is a specific group grievance in that they feel that they are being persecuted and not being given the same opportunities that others are being given. So are we going to see a Tehran versus Riyadh proxy battle in Bahrain? I think Iran often displays strategic patience in these kind of situations. To some extent, they can just sit back and allow events to play themselves out, and they may gain some advantage that way. In the case of Egypt, as the uprising began, Iranian authorities were very vocal, virtually cheering on the protesters in Tahrir Square. Whereas in Bahrain, they were much more muted, much more muted. We're starting to see a few editorials in the Iranian press critical of Saudi Arabia. And by the way, we're starting to see Saudi editorials much more critical of Iran. In the same newspaper, Al-Watan, recently they've had some editorial cartoons very critical of Iran, which tells you something about Saudi opinions of Iran. The fact that they're allowing these sort of editorial cartoons to be published, which they were not allowing to be published in the past. And so this is the broad brushstrokes of the environment that I see. I would say that if we go back to the very beginning of what I talked about and Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's reaction to the WikiLeaks speech, this is not the 1980s all over again. This is not the days of confrontation, the days of open conflict, the days when Iranian leaders were calling for the overthrow of Gulf rulers, and Iran and Gulf rulers, to a large extent, were financing a major power, i.e. Saddam Hussein, to fight a war against Iran. We're not back at those days, but it's certainly not the 1997 through roughly 2003 honeymoon period under Mohammad Khatami either. So we're going back to the period of an environment of suspicion, an environment of frustration on both sides, and an environment in which both sides could potentially make miscalculations that would have strategic implications for all of us. So why don't I end it there, and I'd be happy to take questions. Thank you very much.
We open the floor to questions. Please state who you are and ask your question, as we always do.
Sir, I'm Paul Dameron, the Chief of Staff of Marine Corps University. What would you see as the Saudi definition of success in Bahrain? What would be their exit strategy? What would they want to see achieved there?
Yeah. No, it's a good question. I mean, I think ultimately their definition of success would be, a return to the status quo pre-Pearl, I suppose, pre-Pearl Square. They're probably understand they may not get to that step, that status quo pre-Pearl Square and pre the uprising. And so ultimately their definition of success would be a Bahrain in which the Khalifa ruling family still has real power. I don't think a constitutional monarchy would be their definition of success, even if that calmed the situation down. I think they would be very wary of that model because they would be wary of their own population seeing that potential model. And you have to remember, Bahrain is a fellow member of the Gulf Cooperation Council states, and the GCC states, while they have a lot of differences on particular policies, they basically are structured politically in roughly the same way, a ruling family, which has real power. And so that's ultimately the Saudi definition of success, is the ruling Khalifa family maintaining real power and not devolving power to some sort of a parliament or some sort of constitutional monarchy. Your guess is as good as mine of whether they're going to get that, though. But that's how I would define it.
If I may, Bahrain has officially at least offered a series of 7 steps, one of which comes very close to parliament. And whether the Saudis are happy with that or not, but there are specifics that have been offered by the Crown Prince, who's right now been put in charge of kind of, if you would, negotiations. they're also talking about naturalization of people who are of Shia but claim to be of Bahraini origin. They're also talking about what other issues of fair distribution of power, because Shias can serve in many areas, for example, military, intelligence, and also police.
They have served in the police, but not at the high levels. Yeah.
So those are on the table. Whether those will actually be implemented is an open question. Dr. Wilson.
Chair Wilson, would you care to offer an opinion on what the U.S. has done or not done in these instances?
Sure. Sure, I'd be happy to. I think in the case of, and these instances, you know, the whole region as a whole, is it? Yeah. I think in the case of Egypt, it was a very difficult situation. I think what we did in speaking out for these what President Obama refers to as universal values, I think is probably the best thing we can do. And because after all, we don't want to be seen as on the wrong side of history, which is why, to some extent, I'm a little bit mystified at our reaction to Libya. Because here was an opportunity where it's not necessarily an ally, and where we could have worked with the coalition to come to some sort of agreement on either a no-fly zone or some sort of effort. Extraordinary, the Arab League came together and argued and actually invited foreign intervention. That doesn't happen. And this may, you know, maybe the policy has shifted as a result of the Arab League's call for intervention in Libya. You probably might know better than I where the Obama administration is going with this. But I think that here was an opportunity for the United States to use, you know, significant military power to come to the aid of a particular group that has asked for it under the banner of an Arab League invitation, and that one it seems like we've been a little bit slow on that one. Maybe there's some people in this room who, you know, I'm sure there's everyone in this room knows more about me, about the difficulties of no-fly zones and that sort of thing, but as a lay observer, I thought this was an opportunity that we were currently missing. And when it comes to Bahrain, it's a complex subject. I mean, I think as a general rule, and I've told this to Obama administration officials when they've asked me about Iran. I said, as a general rule, it's always good to stand on the right side of history and to stake a claim that you believe in values of human rights and democracy, and that people who assemble freely should not be shot at, should not be killed. But you don't get involved in the weeds, you know. You don't take a side. You don't say, therefore, Mir Hussein Mousavi, the Iranian Green Movement leader, you know, ought to be thwarted. Therefore, Sheikh Ali Salman, the leader of Al-Wafaq in Bahrain, should be thwarted. Don't get involved in the weeds. Speak in broad, general terms about these principles. And ultimately, we probably have to be a little bit modest about where, you know, and how we are going to, whether we can direct, you know, these uprisings. The only one I thought where we actually do have a role to play is in Libya. And I think that, this is my own personal opinion, I think that we've been a little bit slow on the take in Libya.
Before the next question, one second, I will just make one short announcement, which I forgot, was about our last talk, which is next lecture and last lecture, would be by Dr. Trita Parsi, who is president of National Iranian American Council. This is basically the largest Iranian American Council functioning in the United States, to basically working with the United States Congress and other areas. And that will be on Thursday, 21 April, right here, same time at 1400. And I think this will look more at the options and relationship between the United States and Iran, both from a domestic aspect and a foreign aspect. Trita's book is on Iran-Israel-U.S. relations, so I'm sure he will also discuss that.
And if I may just add to the last part about, and then the Obama administration's response to Iran in particular, one thing that I think that If you look at the history of Iran-U.S. relations, and maybe treading into Trisa's territory, but he knows I always tread into his territory, is that when you look at this diplomatic, tango that is taking place between Iran and the United States since roughly 1995, often when one side has been ready to tango, the other has not been ready to tango. And the Obama administration, I think, made a very serious outreach effort to Iran. And Iran has not reciprocated. And a very brief thumbnail history of the sort of, if you go from 95 to today. In 1995, Hashemi Rafsanjani, as president of Iran, reached out to the United States. And he did it in the way a merchant would. Hashemi Rafsanjani is the epitome of the millionaire mullah. He's actually a billionaire mullah rather than a millionaire mullah, but he's a, one of the things that we have to remember when we study the Islamic Republic of Iran is we can't always necessarily think in terms of esoteric Shiite theological questions. We ought to think also in terms of third world kleptocracies. Hashemi Rafsanjani is the epitome of that sort of, a millionaire mullah who used access to cheap credit lines, etc. Well, Hashemi Rafsanjani reached out to Conoco, the American oil company, and offered them an offshore oil concession. Well, Bill Clinton, a couple of years earlier, had announced U.S. policy of dual containment, the dual containment of Iraq and Iran, and he wasn't about to this was widely seen as a gesture of an outreach. And so Bill Clinton responded by issuing an executive order banning all American business with Iran in 95. 99, when President Mohammad Khatami was in power, President Mohammad Khatami was making noises about dialogue of civilization, et cetera, et cetera. Bill Clinton was in his last year in office, and Bill Clinton decided to make an outreach effort to Iran. And there was this famous episode of the United Nations General Assembly where Khatami was a little reluctant to reach out to Bill Clinton because he knew hardliners back in Iran were going to hit him if he did. And at the UN General Assembly, Bill Clinton was going out of his way to have an accidental meeting with President Mohammad Khatami in the halls of the General Assembly. And Khatami was going out of his way to not have an accidental meeting with Bill Clinton. And he succeeded. But Secretary Madeleine Albright gave a very important speech in which she openly apologized for the 1953 CIA-supported coup d'etat that overthrew a popularly elected nationalist prime minister. This was a very important step, but Iran did not reciprocate that time. And then we just fast forward to 2003, when the Iraq war was looking pretty good, and Saddam Hussein's statue fell. Trita knows a lot about this. Iran reached out to the United States through the Swiss embassy in Tehran that handles U.S. interests, and said we're ready to talk, we're ready to negotiate. And at the time, the Bush administration rebuffed that offer. Enter Barack Obama, and he has written two letters to the Supreme Leader. Ayatollah Ali Khamenei has spoken very seriously about an engagement with Iran, and Iran has not reciprocated. And I'll just leave you with this. There was a member of Iran's Chamber of Commerce who I saw at a conference in Europe, and he was very frustrated with Iranian officials, saying, Obama offered us a great opportunity, we should have taken him up on it. I have to give you a little bit of background before I tell you then how he phrased it. During the 2008 elections in the United States, there was a Iranian blogger who unearthed a 14th century Shiite theological text. And in that text, it said, 500 years from now, out of America, there will emerge, out of the West, there will emerge a man from Africa, with Barack Obama's, Kenyan roots, and he will be with us. Now, how do you say the one who was with us in Persian? Obama. So this kind of caught hold there you go, Obama is the one who was with us. So this caught hold in Iranian cyberspace. His middle name being Hossein, the most important Shiite figure, the prince of all martyrs, and his first name, Barak in Arabic, which means blessed. And his response to this was, I said, well, maybe the Iranian officials don't want to do a deal with the United States. And he said, you're right. If we can't do a deal with the blessed Hussein who is with us, who can we do a deal with? You know? So a long way to respond to your
question. Captain Carroll, please. Start with that IPNC program. You mentioned briefly how about King Abdullah referring to Martin Shah's T-boy,
right.
His personal dislike.
Right.
Is there something more to it? Is Iran one of these countries where there's more like an aristocracy still, even beside just regarding the revolution and all that stuff?
Yeah.
Are the power brokers still of these royal or aristocratic lineages, and that's really who controls socially and then politically what's going on? And then if that is so, can you comment also a little bit on the viability of the opposition? Should they have any of those folks?
Sure. It's a good question, because it raises the whole issue of a lot of people talk about Egypt and the revolution in Egypt and Tunisia and the revolution in Egypt, and revolutions really have to upend a social order and elites. And to a large extent, Iran's revolution did. And so the old aristocracy is largely out. And there's kind of a new aristocracy that has emerged. It's kind of an Islamic Republic of Iran aristocracy. But when King Abdullah's reference to that, it does not have to do with that point. It has more to do with this sense. And again, right now I'm just telling you what I'm hearing, what I've heard as a journalist and as a observer of events of the past. Since 2007, 2008, I was attended several high-level conferences in Riyadh, including an OPEC Heads of State Summit, an Arab League Heads of State Summit. And at the OPEC Heads of State Summit, that Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was there, I happened to be speaking to a Saudi journalist who had brought me to visit with one of the top aides of Prince Salman, the governor of Riyadh. And as Mahmoud Ahmadinejad walked by, this top aide said, "I can't believe Iran is such an old and sophisticated civilization. How could they have this man, as president?" So there is kind of a looking down on him as a sort of an uncouth bomb thrower who says outrageous things, whereas they look at Mohammad Khatami as a philosopher who at least knew how to speak diplomatically, and so it has a lot more to do with that that kind of thinking. And when it comes to this green movement, the last part of your question, I think one of the benefits of the democratic movement in Iran today is that in the long term is that it is being led by men and women who were Islamists not long ago. And who were leaders of the 1979 revolution, and who have kind of, the Islamist fever has gone out of their body. Iranians, in my estimation, are in a post-Islamist phase right now. They don't have romantic, foggy notions of what an Islamic government might look like, because they've lived under one, And when you've lived under one, you see that, hey, guess what? The price of meat is actually higher. The price of tomatoes are higher. Traffic is just as bad. Guess what? These mullahs, they're just as good at stealing as the Shah and his cronies were. Whereas, in places like Egypt and Jordan, there is still this Islam al-Hal. Islam is the solution. There is this romance about Islamic government. Oh, Islamists certainly couldn't steal money, could they? Islamists certainly couldn't, and so you still have that romance, but Iranians don't have that romance. And I think that there's a benefit that this movement in Iran is being led by sort of bearded former Islamists who are speaking a very powerful language of a democracy. Just here at Georgetown University, there's a guy by the name of Abdul Karim Sirush. Abdul Karim Sirush is an Islamic philosopher who was one of the leaders of the purging of Iran's universities in the early 1980s, purging them of leftists and secular forces, and now he's one of the leading critics of Islam. And he comes at it from a philosophical perspective, in which he says that in religion, you're dealing with sacred truths. In politics, you're dealing with malleable truths. And when you bring religion into the political sphere, those political truths suddenly become sacred, and what is that really? That's fascism, you know? And so I think that's actually powerful, that it's these former Islamists, former revolutionaries who are leading the charge in Iran.
Yes, please. Sir, does that call Saul on the military as well as the CSIS? Follow up on the, you talked about the Green Movement. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Iran dealt with Egypt, Tunisia-like civil unrest in a very brutal fashion, probably a very effective fashion from a regime standpoint. But now, having had the Arab Spring, mm-hmm. having had all those images beamed into Iran, does this have an effect of re-energizing the Green Movement? Yeah. What is the future now in light of what's happened the last couple months?
Yeah, no, it's a very important question because, to some extent, Egyptian activists tell me that they were inspired by 2009 Iranian protests. And if you noticed this guy from Google, Wael Bonim, the Google executive, he was wearing this green headband, green wristband. It was, you know, the green being the symbol of the Iranian Green Movement. And then Iranians were re-inspired by the Egyptians and the Tunisians, and certainly that had an effect, and it will continue to have an effect. But I think you characterized it correctly in terms of the brutal efficiency with which the Iranian authorities dealt with the uprising compared to Egypt. I was just talking to some Iranians recently, and they were watching the CNN television coverage of the uprising in Egypt. And one of the things that they were surprised at and shocked at, and they said something quite interesting, they said that, you know, we were amazed that Mohammed al-Baradei, the Egyptian opposition leader, was on TV every night, was on CNN every night. The Iranian equivalent of Mohammed al-Baradei would have already been in jail. If he wasn't in jail, and if he made it to TV one night, he would have been thrown in jail the next day, along with the cameraman who filmed him and the journalist who put him on air. You know, there's a way to do these things, and the Iranian authorities are very efficient at deploying surgical violence. They're pretty good at not having a Tiananmen Square type moment, but they're pretty good at deploying surgical violence. I've been in the environment, in these kind of environments in Iran when I was a reporter there, and I can just give you a little bit of color of what that's like. It's very intimidating, and this was 2003, 2004 when it wasn't even at this level of intimidation. But I was trying to get to Tehran University to attend a protest, and I knew I was going to have trouble. So I turned to one of my sources who was in the Basij volunteer militia. You know, these guys were sort of, you know, the head crackers. Now my source was actually a former member of the Basij, a war veteran. You know, a guy, you know, a middle-aged guy with a, you know, family. He's not one of the guys who goes out and beats people up, you know, in protest. So, but he told me he would take me to the Tehran University protest. So we got on the back of his motorcycle. And what was amazing is Tehran is a city of intersections and squares and circles. And if you can prevent people from gathering, you can prevent them from gathering by cutting off the squares and cutting off the bypasses. And just at every square, every circle, every bypass, there was cut off by police authorities and members of the Basij militia. And we managed to get through a couple of them because he would flash his car, and you know. But as we got closer to Tehran University, it was hard to get through, and they actually would question him. And at one point, he almost came to blows because there was this sort of 17-year-old wispy, mustachioed, you know, Basij. And this guy was saying, you know, I fought in this war with Iraq, and you know, when you were, you know, still, you know. Suckling your mother's milk. This was the version, the phrase he used, you know, and he was, you know, really getting angry with him, and he almost punched him in the face. It was, you know, getting that serious. And then finally we got through. Once we got there, helicopters circling overhead, revolutionary guardsmen on motorbikes, members of the Ansara Hezbollah, which is a sort of a pressure group that is loosely affiliated with the government, rushing into crowds, chanting Allahu Akbar, gathering people, putting them into vans. Very intimidating environment, to the point where after seeing it once, I said, I've seen enough, you know. I didn't want to go back again for the next night of protests, and you know, here I was, if I ever gotten in trouble, I at least had a press pass, I at least had a reason to be there, that I might have been detained for a few hours and taken away, but I had enough. So you can imagine, multiply that by four or five, and this was the environment that we were seeing in Iran in 2009, 2010. And 2011. It's an entirely different environment than Egypt or Tunisia.
No, somebody was on this side. Okay, go ahead, please.
Farhan Pashak with Booz Allen. I was reading Carolyn Times recently at the English language newspaper, and on the front page it had a picture of a new doll called Amu Nowruz, Uncle Nowruz, that looked strikingly similar to a Santa Claus. And behind it a green tree. And this doll is endorsed by the Ministry of Culture in Iran. And it's going to be available for Nowruz to all the Iranian children as the new doll that symbolizes Nowruz and the civilization that lies behind that day. And to me, that was kind of ironic. I wonder what your thoughts are.
Yeah, interesting. I didn't see the story. Describe, what did the doll look like? Did the doll have a beard?
The doll had a beard.
Okay.
Had a vest.
Had a vest. Okay.
It had a beard.
Obviously, no necktie.
None of that. Yeah. But the tree behind it was strikingly similar to Christmas tree.
Okay. Yeah.
And the doll itself.
It looked like Uncle Sam, really. Okay.
Yeah, it looked very.
Kind of a white, avuncular beard?
Yes.
Okay.
Not completely white, sort of grayish.
Oh, grayish. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Now that's interesting. I have not seen this story, but I mean, I can, you know, on a broad level, you know, the Ministry of Culture was fighting a war with Barbie a few years ago. Do you remember that? Where they had banned Barbie in Iran, and they had come up with their own doll called the Sara doll, and it was and you could buy various, you know, headscarves and, you know, various accessories for this Sara doll. And, you know, these kind of things, what is interesting about these efforts of the Ministry of Culture, they spend a lot of money, they roll these things out, and the Iranian youth ignore it, you know. They spend a lot of money on their propaganda, they roll things out, and the Iranian youth ignore it. Khomeini once said that, you know, we need people to go forth and procreate, because we need, 20 million soldiers of the Islamic army. Well, they do have 20 million soldiers, but these 20 million soldiers are ignoring, you know, these dictates that come from the Ministry of Culture, asking for, you know. And one of the other things that I found in Iran, but also when I travel in Egypt and Jordan and Tunisia and other places, is people are not asking for much. They're asking for a sense of normalcy, a decent job, you know, proper health care, opportunities, and their voice to be heard. And this is what Iranians are asking for. So when they see these kind of things, it is very striking how they ignore it. And the last point on this is that state television. Now, if you are in a home, and many middle-class Iranian homes have satellite TV, it's very rare that you will find in that home people gather to watch state television news, unless there's been riots or protests and they want to see what Ayatollah Khamenei has to say or what an important official has to say. They generally are watching the BBC Persian service or the Voice of America Persian service, or they're generally watching Turkish television soap operas. There's a whole generation of young Iranians who've learned Turkish because of the Turkish soap operas and game shows, you know, that they're watching on TV. And it's very rare do you find that. And I used to watch, I used to go to families' homes or middle class, you know, families' homes, and when the news would come on, as a journalist, I wanted to see what they were saying. And everybody would clear out, you know, and they didn't want to be in the same room as the news. So they're just kind of not buying this stuff. And they're buying, you know, which, by the way, the most popular program right now in Iran, by far, is a program called Parazit. Have you heard about this? Have you read about this? It's a program that is produced by the Voice of America Persian service. It is a couple of young guys who do a Jon Stewart-type Daily Show program, and millions of viewers in Iran. The host of the show said that, you know, he literally has no time for his Facebook or has no time for his emails, because he'll literally get 5,000 emails or 5,000 Facebook, you know, requests, you know, message requests from Iran whenever he does one of his shows. And so it's really right now one of the most popular shows in Iran. So these kind of things that the government officially is trying to tell the Iranian people generally don't go over very well with the people.
Just on a more serious issue, one quick question. How do you assess Iran's relationship with Al-Qaeda nowadays? I've read several articles that there's increasing contact between Iran and Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
And there's been evidence of Iran supporting Taliban, or elements of Iran supplying weapons to the Taliban.
Yeah.
Where do you see Iran when it comes to Afghanistan and Pakistan?
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think Dr. Tarzi would probably know the answer to this question better than I, but I'll just give you my own brief answer. Which was, you know, again articulated to me by a senior Iranian official. He didn't come out and say it in these words, but what he was saying essentially is it is not in our interest for there to be a successful, prosperous, economically powerful democracy in Afghanistan. And the same for Iraq. It's not in their interest because there's a demonstration effect to their own Iranian population. And so what does Iran do? Iran plays Afghanistan and Iraq to some extent like a reckless gambler might play the roulette table where you bet on a lot of different chips, you know, and you hope that you... So you support the government of Afghanistan, but then you also offer some assistance to the Taliban, you flirt with the Taliban. Because ultimately, if your goal is to bog down the United States, and for the United States not to have a successful mission in Iraq or in Afghanistan, then these are the actors that you deal with to ensure that the United States does not have a successful mission. Is that your impression?
Those who have heard me talk about Afghanistan and Iran and Afghanistan, I usually start saying, if you look at Afghanistan as a roulette table, Iran is a chip.
Oh, there
you
go.
That's my final mantra. Yeah. And they are, in my view, I can't say it anymore like that. They don't want to boil the either Iraqi pot or African pot, but they want both of them to simmer.
Yeah.
Because a success in either country makes the American or Western promise a reality, which goes directly against this whole idea they're saying that these are occupiers, they're destroying the culture. So, this is an issue, so that's why sometimes it seems contradictory, because on one hand they help, the projects, they're very helpful, on the other hand they, you know, they fight the drugs, they use the same drug routes to arm the Taliban,
right?
And some people say, oh, the Taliban are these very hardcore Sunnis, how can they do it? As you said, Iran is a survivalist, it's not ideological,
right?
If the Taliban help to destabilize the situation, why not? It's not that they want the Taliban to come to power, they want them to use them to destabilize the situation.
Similar.
I can't say anything better. Please, attend.
Bill Wright, Concordia University. Maybe we could shift a little bit geographically and also for politics more into Congress. What is Iran's relationship with the Chinese?
Oh, yeah.
I know the Chinese are very interested in energy, starting coin, other conferences.
It's an extremely important relationship for Iran. There's a lot of talk about how the China-Iran relationship is a strategic one. I would argue that for Iran, it is absolutely, vitally, 100% strategic. For China, Iran is one of 30 to 35, you know, countries, energy partners that it's dealing with on a regular basis. China has not put in real money into Iran. They're very good at signing big-ticket, billion-dollar contracts with Iran. But when it comes to actually spending the real money in those oil projects, they haven't done it yet. Iran is still waiting to see, and Iran is frustrated by Chinese foot dragging. You know, I often say that China, like its national animal, the panda, that has to eat bamboo 18 hours a day just to survive. China has to eat energy 18 hours a day just to survive, which is why China is just dealing with everyone around the world when it comes to energy. And so Iran is one partner. Now, they have a transactional relationship with Iran. I wouldn't argue that it's a strategic relationship. So they'll buy Iranian oil. They'll sell Iran gasoline because they can make money off of that sale. But when it comes to real money, real strategic partnerships, that's China-Saudi Arabia. Saudi Aramco is building, it has joined with China and are building two major refineries in China. That's a strategic relationship. Hu Jintao, president of China, a very well-traveled man, been to more than 50 countries, has never visited Iran. Look, if you're Sinopec, the Chinese oil company, if you're CNPC, the China National Petroleum Company, you've become a global oil player. And as a global oil player that's listed on stock exchanges, you have a fiduciary responsibility to your shareholders to some extent. And when you invest in Iran in a big way, and you suddenly have U.S. congressmen beating down your door, and U.S. pension funds threatening to divest from your company, you have to ask yourself the question that the chief executive of Total, Christophe de Margerie, said. You have to always ask this question when you're dealing with Iran. Is this particular investment worth the headache? Because the headache will come. The headache will come in U.S. congressional pressure. The headache will come in pension funds, you know, threatening to divest. And the headache will also come with Iranian bureaucracy. You know? And so now, when you look at Iran's oil sector, okay, Iran oil, crude oil accounts for 80% of Iran's hard currency earnings. It accounts for about 50% of Iran's fiscal revenues. So this is absolutely vital to Iran's economic future. When you look at Iran's oil production, and if we were to graph it, the graph would be going down. Iran is producing about 3.7, 3.8 today. Recall they were producing 6 million barrels before the 1979 revolution, producing about 3.7, 3.8 today. They're losing about 400,000 barrels a day per year of production just due to natural decline. Well, as you know, oil fields decline. That's what they do. And if you have money and if you have access to technology, you just make sure your recovery rate is faster than your decline rate. But Iran doesn't have the money, and they don't have access to international oil companies. And so when you take a company like Saudi Aramco in Saudi Arabia, and you look at, you know, 6-7 years ago, Saudi Aramco decided, you know what, we're going to increase our capacity. And what did they do? Banks around the world fell all over themselves to finance Saudi Aramco. Oil field services companies around the world fell all over themselves to get these deals. And within 4 or 5 years, Saudi Arabia ramped up its production capacity 4 million barrels per day. So what did they do? They added Iran to their production capacity. Think about that for a moment. Saudi Arabia said, okay, Iran, you're producing 4 million. We're going to add Iran's production capacity to our own production capacity. And so while Iran's production is on the decline, what do they need? They need investment. There's not a single major multinational European oil company willing to invest in Iran anymore. They've all exited, including the Italian energy company Eni, which has a 50-year relationship with Iran. Exit. So who's left? Sinopec and CNPC, the two major Chinese national oil companies. And so in many ways, Iran's future, its economic future, lies with these two companies. And these two companies are dragging their feet. And they're not putting in the kind of investments that are required. So Iran will probably stay at the 3.6 to 3.7 million barrels per day. They'll manage to, you know, paper over some of the problems. They'll inject more gas into their oil fields and get more. But Iran, the untold story of Iran is this is a country of enormous potential that is dramatically punching below its weight. It is a country with the world's second largest gas reserves, the world's third largest oil reserves. And yet it is, when you look at its per capita income, you look at its economic development indicators, it is punching far below its potential weight. And unless they correct this oil sector problems that they have, they're going to kind of tread water in their oil sector. And guess who's going to pass them in about 3 or 4 years? Iraq. If Iraq gets even close to the oil projection figures that the oil industry analysts are suggesting for Iraq, which is 7 million barrels per day production by 2015, 12 million by 2020, again, those may be optimistic. But even if they get close to those, within 3 or 4 years, Iraq is going to surpass Iran and going to become the second largest OPEC producer. So what are the geopolitical ramifications for that? What are the Iran-Iraq relationship ramifications for that when Iraq is saying, Iran, hold on a minute, we've got a lot of money in here. You know, we don't need so much your aid anymore. We don't need your infrastructure assistance support anymore. You know, is there going to be tensions in the relationship as a result? So you know, the Iran-China relationship, absolutely strategic for Iran. For China, it's more of a transactional relationship.
Before I close this one, I think we are getting to the end of the time. One other short announcement which has nothing to do with us, it has to do a little bit with my person, but it has to do with Iran. Those of you who want to go to Washington on 24 March, the Reserve Officers Association has a half a day conference called Iran and the Threat to Israel and its Neighbors. It will start at 0800 and goes until 1430. It is on 1 Constitution Avenue Northeast. If you want more information, please contact Adam Sykes or myself upstairs or send an email and we'll let you know. This is not sponsored by us, but I will be closing the keynote speaker on that thing. With that, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.